16 pretty maidens to carry my coffin. 16 pretty maidens to sing me a song. With bunches of roses over my coffin. So I'll look pretty as I ride along. Go tell my baby sister,
like Sister Odetta to do that.
Yeah.
Oh boy. I did that in honor of the goddess, as the Republicans dishonored the goddess and struck down the equal pay for equal work. Ledbetter Act, right?
Lily Ledbetter.
Lily Ledbetter. Okay, we were reading a little bit about the Grand Cross, and bearing the Grand Cross is where we're at. And that it has to do with this blood moon coming in. This is the biggest change our little planet here has ever seen. Not ever has it been like this. And we are the foundation of making it so. As the greater the wisdom, the greater responsibility we have to share this and bring everybody else at least the message so that they have something they can do about it. Choose, choose, choose. We have free will choice. The layers of your crystalline auric field are still somewhat in flux, still stabilizing for most of us. The expansions can and do affect, to varying degrees, our sensory systems and emotional field. Bearing the cross, the Grand Cross. In 2014, the aspects of inner conflict will move into the crucible phase for purification. Any dishonesty, any flaws that were hidden, any shadows will come into light in order to be faced. Align our actions to highest goals. Prioritize, prioritize, prioritize. Examine our paths and plan our journeys consciously. Life can be difficult, and that is a great truth. However, it isn't only through facing our challenges that we transcend them. We are not only graduate students in the University of Earth. We are the professors who wrote the curriculum in higher realms. Mental focus is required. Now, that's about the fourth time I heard that phrase. Yet, we have the tools to walk the path of mastery. We cannot sit complacently on the fence in the Grand Cross energies. We will be affected. We urge us to embrace it, for although it will have its challenges, it is an exquisite, benevolent resonance. Dear hearts, the harmonic trigger and stargate of 2014 is the perfect opportunity to determine the missing pieces of the puzzle. It is indeed time to make our mark. To contribute our path, to consider the legacy our life will be. And yes, indeed, it involves putting all the final pieces together. Assembly is required. The crystalline frequency is beginning even more powerfully in 2014. It's becoming even more powerful in 2014. This is a resonance that increasingly shall influence each of us into our impeccability. Impeccability is simply understanding, overstanding who we are and becoming true to self, capital S, capital E, capital L, capital F, in the highest standards. It requires us each to take our power and walk in integrity, and that is the earmark of true mastery. It is time for the masters among us to take part and move into wisdom, heart, courageous action. We told ourselves that there would be timings in 2014 in which we will be compelled to focus on those remaining areas of our life stream that need to be addressed. That time is now. We will be required to confront the self and prioritize, prioritize, prioritize what actions are needed. Redefine our inner contracts. Determine how we wish to utilize our remaining time on planet Earth. We will be compelled to seize the moment and make a bucket list. Linear life is a quantum of our heartbeats. Seize the day. It is in time indeed to write the book within ourselves. Time for the dreamer to awaken. It is the time of the grand cross and the portal of harmony. I am Metatron, and I share with you these truths. We are all beloved. And so it is, and it is so. Wow, wow, wow. I don't think you could say it plainer than that, everybody.
No.
Okay, we're going to go to a global spirit event. I mean, we could listen to the news until the cows come home, and there's always going to be more. This is a lovely global spirit, so let me get it first. Let's see here. Dum-de-dum-de-dum. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. I gotta look it up here. Duh. I guess I'll just read this one time again. Kay Pacha said, I am so anxious, I am ready to burst. It is hard to decide what to do first. I must remember that in this dimension, time holds the keys to my future expansion. There is so much chaotic energy swirling around us and this planet right now that it is easy to get swept into it, like getting sucked into a tornado. It is a test of our self-mastery to hold and manage our energy now. As managed well, this great new power emerging within each of us can and shall bring forth the new earth. Enjoy. And he said the eagle and the dove are, eagle and the dove, those are two scorpionic energies. Remember, you start with the scorpion, go to the swan, divine grace, go to the dove, peace, inner peace, and then go to the eagle, the spirit messenger, and then the phoenix rises out of the dust of those ashes. And Dane Rudyer, he said, is saying that at this time, the eagle and the dove are spinning so fast they become each other. They've literally become each other. Mother, father, sister, brother. Okay, now where did I write that down? Oh. Moment. Tito, yeah, I wrote it down so I would have the date that it was at. Thought it was on the 8th, but I didn't see it there. I'll go back down there and just try it again. We're on the 8th. Okay, keep going. I guess it's farther up. Yeah, I think it's farther up. It's the end of the day. Sorry, everybody. We'll get there. No, no, no. You have, there we go. All right. Here, Rama, you got to put this over there. Okay, we're going to move this just a moment, Tito.
It's coming.
When Whether expressed through sculpture, music, painting, or dance, art is one of the few human endeavors that can open a special doorway to higher human consciousness. In most world religions, what is called sacred or spiritual art is intended to transport both the artist and the witness into a more direct relationship with God, the deities, or the spiritual forces that are represented. As a writer, I'm fascinated by the unique ability of art to foster realizations and transformations of all kinds. For today's show, we've invited two guests from two very different but related cultural traditions. Lama Lanang Rinpoche is a Tibetan Lama and painter from the Nyingma tradition. That is, he's a Lama who lives and works in the world rather than living a secluded monastic life. Today, Lama Lanang paints and teaches the Buddhist Dharma in East Los Angeles. From the Jemez Pueblo near Santa Fe, we've invited a Native American sculptor named Estella Loreto, well known throughout the Southwest for her bold designs, her mythic vision, and her extraordinary artistic talent. Estella has traveled all over the world, including India, where she met many Tibetan people. And just by bringing these two artists and traditions together, I'm wondering if there'll be some spark of recognition of the distant historic affinity between the Native American and the Tibetan cultures. Welcome to Art and the Creative Spirit. Welcome to Global Spirit. Today I'm very excited to be able to have the chance to talk about creativity, the creative spirit with you. I'm absolutely fascinated by the notion of this life force called creativity that moves through us. Can you describe what this creative spirit is in your life and in your work?
Before I answer, Phil, I'd like to light a couple of candles that I brought. And it is to ignite the creative spirit of this conversation and for all of us being together. Thank you.
Yes.
It's just so wonderful to have these candles. In the world, all the religion, they always use the light or the internal light or any sacred places, they always use the light. In Tibet, we use a butter lamps for world peace through the inner peace. So we're going to send the light to the world with peace and happiness.
Lama, would you like to give us an opening prayer over these candles and bless our show?
Yes.
Thank you. That's a wonderful way to spark the creativity of our show. And now, can you tell us, how does this notion of the creative spirit inspire your own work?
I think there's so much ideas in my mind. Too many things, ideas comes to my mind. I have very wild creative spirit. I think it has so many ideas come in my mind. So I have to reduce some and to make more focused to few things.
How about you, Estella? Can you describe what this creative spirit is in your life and in your work?
I really believe that creating art is a very deep spiritual process. it really brings out the depth of where you are in your life, what is occurring in your life in the moment, and how you want to express your inner feelings, your prayer, and how you want to share it with the world.
Lama, can everybody be an artist? Can everybody be creative?
Oh, absolutely. We knowingly or unknowingly, we're creating some art. If you took a step, each step is creating art. Each you say one words, it's become, the words is art. And also life is art. But what kind of art you want, the creative spirit with you, the spirit of light or spirit of dark, which energy you focus, that energy brings that drawing or that art. So what I'm saying is everything is art, is what you see, everything, houses, mountains, beautiful art, ocean, it's so beautiful art. But the inner art is the best when you create a beautiful picture inside your heart. That is always there. Nobody can take it. Nobody can erase it. It stays with you. That's why it's the meditation is the most the beautiful art. It's called ultimate art.
Well, this is a great chance for us then to enter your world and look at some of your art.
Yes, thank you. Lama means like teacher, and in the Indian school, guru, and in the Western it's often called master, in Chinese called sansu, in Tibetan it's called lama. La means the highest knowledge. Ma means like a mother. Mother is always kind to the child. Same way lamas, you have to kind to everyone. That's sort of the responsibility in lama's job. Means is the truth. Buddha means fully enlightened energy. I believe is there's so many different religions. They think is the, our God, our the past. But to me is everybody speaking is the truth is the same. It's like you know there's many millions lectures, light bulbs, but the electrical energy is only one energy. Everything is art. To me, is everything you see is art. Everything you hear is art. Everything you feel is art. I will always draw a lot of birds and dolphins in my drawings. Because the dolphins, when I see so, they're free spirit. They jump, they dance, they sing, they groups. And we need that. The birds, dolphins, sea, and mountains, the beautiful country, is a beautiful art already we live in. I'm just trying to remind people to try to make so these connections. Say, okay, look at this, the beauty of these things. So that's why my art changes to more like a sort of natural, happy feelings, because in this country, people need more happy spirits.
This one is painted by Baba Sama, who brought Buddhism to Tibet in the 7th century. All the Buddhas sitting in lotus, because lotus is a symbol of compassion. Our lotus is like our heart. When we visualize Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the wisdom and compassion in our heart, that make opens our heart is like a lotus.
Lama, how do you use art in your teachings? Is it an important part of your spiritual work?
Yes, you can meditate on mandala or deities or colors or places, all a relative art. But also if you use a relative art to found the ultimate art in your heart, also, art has a message about, if you see somebody's art, you can know what's going on in their mind. So it's a very beautiful way you can see it with the art. And because the art, what somebody drawing or sculpture or carving, because there's always connect with it in their heart. So the spirit tells the message about what's going on in a person's head or heart. Or you feel like in America, people think it's the head, but in Asia, we think it's heart. So either way, in mind.
Estella, do you see any parallels with your own work?
Yes, I do. It's just starting your day with a prayer and kind of being mindful in every moment on how you are walking, how you are moving through the day, and how you want to share your day, how you want to use your day. And really, for me, it's like, what is going to give me joy in my day? So a lot of it, is creating. Creating art gives me a lot of joy. It's very therapeutic, and I feel that in my heart I'm most peaceful when I'm in my studio creating my art.
It's a wonderful place for us to make a transition then into Estella's world.
The pieces are a part of me. I'm producing them, so they're like become like my children. When they leave home, you want to make sure they're beautiful, they're well-dressed and happy to be out in the world. This clay is an oil clay, and it's mixed with vegetable oil, and it doesn't have any toxic fumes. So I warm it up, and you can very easily, you know, put it on. It's very flexible. I think it's very sensuous, and it never dries, so it gives me plenty of time to grow with the piece. For me, this symbol represents new beginnings. This piece is an unfolding of a dance, relationships that we have, maybe a relationship between a man and a woman, and the balance that needs to be kept. It's a dance going on. I guess it's a dance going on with me personally and one of them. Sometimes I'm just trying to learn with the piece, you know, letting the piece teach me. So it's a study. I don't know where it's going to go. But I can kind of see this going like that. and turning into just an energy. I'm going to try working with this for a few days, and if I feel like it's changing now, I just cut her off and just keep going with that energy. Actually, that's kind of what I'm seeing. To kind of meditate on it and pray about it for the courage just to be able to let go. Because it takes some courage to just let go. It feels good though to do it.
I loved how you described some of your pieces as your children. It's a very intimate metaphor for a work of art. Can you talk about that?
Well, you put so much of yourself and you spend so much time with the piece and the pieces that you know, like when I do the faces, you know, I'm, you know, just packing the clay and then I start creating the nose, the mouth, and then I love it when I get to open their eyes and I love it when I kind of create their smile. And I always try to make them in a position where they're very comfortable, you know, because they have to sit that way for a while or they'll have to stand that way for a while. So I want them to be very balanced and have harmony and just have a comfortable place for the whole energy of what I'm trying to create.
That moment when you create the eyes, when you paint the eyes in, is that the moment when the spirit enters the work and it becomes alive?
I think it's always there, you know, as you start the whole process. But for me, when I do the eyes and I start doing the face, I feel like it's starting to look at me now, you know, that I'm starting to have a relationship with the piece. You know, so it's like my child. It becomes like a part of me. And you're giving birth. You're giving birth to an energy.
Lama, I'm very curious about your response to Estella's reflections about the art spirit.
It shows me as like this clear and beautiful sculpture. And then she destroyed, as it shows the sort of the everything comes, goes in impermanence. And we don't know what's coming in next moment. Everything is a mystery. We don't know in next hour what's going to be. So the moment is the gift we have. And also the way she works with in the clay and the vegetable oils, I think I like that, and it's beautiful work.
Estella, I'm very struck by your comments about learning from your own work. How do you get this dialogue to move back and forth where you're creating something and then you listen to it? How does that work?
You know, you start every day and you start with a ball of clay and you start moving with it, and every moment is different. And then at a certain point of the day, you know, maybe you have to go work out, play with your granddaughter. You have other things to do, so you take a break and you come again in the morning. And the next day it unfolds in a different way, maybe unlike you expected yesterday. And you're open to the change. You're open to wherever it wants to take you. I don't get so stuck on where I want it to go.
Right.
You know, like when I took off the head, I can take it off, play with it, but if this other doesn't work, I can take that off and put that back. You know, so it gives me a chance to dance with it, to have fun with it, and just to see where I am that might make me feel good, you know. But I always feel that we are changing. We have to be willing to change, to let go and to move forward.
Does this make sense to you, Lama? That when we're creating, when we're making something new, when we're inventing, we're growing as human beings.
Yes. When I was come to America, was I have to start life in begin because I grew up in Asia, was a sort of, if you are chosen, you are Lama, then is sort of, they treat you so different way, right? You come to America, you have to start everything from the zero. So, but I appreciate it because I learned to cook and how to make a garden, how to paint a house, and just said I just painted my temple and things like that. And then sort of every day is learning and growing. And so, you know, sometimes in America, we think it's like we lost one job or something, then we think it's lost the whole world. There's more opportunities if you see that, because you lost one thing, you focus, you lost, then there's so many opportunities opens to you. You can work in and learning, enjoying. The way you enjoy, you're learning.
So does that mean when we're not creating, when we're not making something, we're stagnant or even falling backwards?
Some people are stuck. They think they can't do it. They don't have hope. So they raise up the ignorance to limit themselves to sort of the push down themselves, to closing themselves to, oh, I don't have hope. I can't. That means you sort of closing yourself. But if you say, I can't, this is so wonderful. I will well do it this way, that way. Then there's beautiful, more confidence and the more clear vision opens towards you.
Does this mean that art can heal us?
I feel we are creating work. I think that will transform environments. At least that's what I want to do. If you bring home a piece of art, it will shift your home. It will transform a space because it has energy. And I try to do art that is very serene and very peaceful. And I hope that, you know, wherever they go, that's what it brings to an environment.
I feel always their art is not just only drawing, you know. There's inner art, which is meditation and visualization. As we, as a person, always we think Buddha or the truth is somewhere, you know. Somewhere have to go to get there, you know. We have to go to Buddha Gaya, we have to go to India, we have to go to a place to really connect with the Buddha. But if really we have a trust and faith strong enough, then you don't need to go anywhere. We are the one as the center of universe. We are the one already connected to Buddha. So this person understands that moment, and this girl, she like sort of opens her heart. Oh, Buddha is not somewhere. In that moment, she feels like raining flowers and the rainbows comes to her. And she feels that moment is beyond words, beyond thoughts. She gets true enlightenment energy, ultimate happiness arise into her heart.
I'm John Cleese, and you are watching Global Spirit, the first internal travel series.
Everybody has a gift of art. Some people have speech art. They can talk beautifully, or they can sing songs and poetry. There are so many beautiful gifts of speech art. Some people has mind art. They can draw, but they can create things in their mind. And we all have dreams and want to create things. It's good. We have gift. This body is useful to create things, to do wonderful things. That's why we are here, to manifest it and do something good things to ourselves and to our families, to in the world, to all the animals, plants. To me, is the happiness, is the success.
I really feel that art isn't always like the most joyful, because in real life you have negative emotions as well. You know, sometimes you have a little hard time. But I think that those experiences also can enhance your art. You know, when those little moments when you maybe have little struggles can make your art more powerful. And then you get happier, you know, because you have negative few moments and they always turn.
This is a really nakedness of our mind, of ordinary person. We all go through these situations. Some people go through every day. Some people go through once in a while. A lot of people don't like. Some people say, what happened that day? I say, nothing happened. This is a great day I painted. Then they ask me, what are you thinking? I said, we are like this. And they said, oh, how? I said to them, this is a symbol of three poisons. So ignorance, anger, attachment. When we use these three poisons, then we begin to suffer. And then we start. We don't know why we're not happy, why we're so much angry, why we can't sleep, why we can't eat, why these things happening. But if we realize, because the three poisons, ignorance, when we don't know what the truth, then we better not judging. And just we know exactly what's going on our mind, but we don't know other people's mind. Better not judging other people's. Only judging ourselves to transform ourselves to be a good person. Anger is you. Even though somebody did something bad to you or something not nice to you, if you're angry, you not destroy that person, you destroy yourself. Anger destroys your family. Anger destroys your friendship. Anger destroys your business. Anger destroys your physical health. Destroys everything. So, you know, in same way, in attachment, we never satisfied. We want something more. When we have a little house in the city, then we want another house in the country. Attachment never satisfies. When you push it, when you have, the richest person in the world. So what I'm saying is, it's like I told some people, I said, okay, just look at this picture. You like this picture? You don't. But this is exactly the truth. The truth, nobody like truth. They like lies, white lies. Oh, you look good. You must be a kind person. Oh, must be you a good person. You wise. People want to hear that. But the truth is like our mind. Sometimes messy is like this.
As a writer, I was raised to believe that just about everything could be described by words. However, I've learned to realize as I've gotten older that there are some experiences, some dimensions that can only be expressed in images. This is a very disturbing image. It seems to be a kind of x-ray of the soul of an angry person. What did you think? What did you feel looking at that image?
At first it seemed I was a little bit confused, and I wanted to ask him, what that was coming out of the eyes, and, you know, I didn't understand it, but it seemed angry and confused. But again, coming to the word courage, I think it took courage for you to do something like that. But I think we all have moments like that. So it's a part of the truth.
Yes, you can look and things coming from ears and eyes and mouth. And when person is a sort of used to the ignorance and attachment, jealousy and pride and in anger, then what they comes to their mouth is never nice. For example, when you are a child, maybe like 5 years old, something, 6, 7 years old, you're in the street, you see somebody yell at you, an angry person, they damage you, and you never forget your entire life in that moment. But if you see somebody has peace and smile and some nice to you and maybe when you're a child, then you never forget that beauty. We have light sides, dark sides. Which one we want to be manifested? It's a choice, it's our motivation. We can make difference, which kind of picture you want. You want picture of Buddha or you want picture of that? That is your choice. So that's why I paint that.
It seems there are many motivations and purposes and reasons for art. Beauty traditionally reminds us of what's life-affirming. It gives us a reason to live. But there's an aspect of this kind of work that's disturbing and maybe pushes us off-center, so we have to think in a new way.
People feel shocked, and a lot of people ask me, so why you paint such like this like evil, painful-looking drawing? And some people may learn from something this because this is the truth. And sometimes, you know, who like anger, but it just automatically rise. But when you anger rise, then you have a chance to look, to transform. Oh, this I don't like. This is the picture of my drawing, like that kind of feelings. But this is the way my teachings come out with my art, to show and say, see, this is sometimes we are like, but it's okay. We can work and we can transform, we can change. So that's way I thought this is a sort of one way I teach with my art.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you like it.
But I'm curious to know if you sold that painting. Did someone buy that painting? Or do you still have it?
I still have it. And also, I was thinking maybe make a t-shirt just by the who gonna wear.
This piece is called Unfolding Blessing. This to me represents whatever you're thinking, the moment, every moment in time. So whatever you're thinking is what you are going to unfold in the moment, in the day, and that becomes your creation. Because it's energy, whatever you're thinking, you're kind of pulling it out there. So the unfolding that I feel like I'm acknowledging in this piece is like celebrating the gift of every moment in this piece turns. I like all my sculptures to be able to turn. If it's in the center, it can be seen on both sides. And I like this side because it's really peaceful and it's quiet. And somewhere I would like to take this is do it like an 8-foot by 8-foot or a 10-foot by 10-foot and remind people of the importance of now, that every moment is this again. So that's what I'm sculpting right now. It's just a moment in time.
I know, there's a wonderful saying in Buddhism, present moment, perfect moment. Can you explore that a little bit?
Well, for me, that's all we have is this moment. And what I was doing in this piece is whatever we are thinking, wherever our heart is, our state of mind, wherever our thoughts are, is the moment. We're giving power to this moment by the way we think. Because whatever you think, you're going to bring in you're going to unfold. So if you think positive, then that becomes your reality. If you are thinking negative, then you bring the doubts, the fear, the negativity, that's what you bring in.
I'm struck also by the title of this piece with the spiral in it, unfolding. Something's unfolding out of the moment. But why blessing? How can a work of art be a blessing?
It's a blessing because it's a prayer. It's a prayer that went into the piece. And when you're working on a piece, you're putting life into it. You're breathing your life into it. You know, we all have so many breaths in our lifetime. And we only have so many. So I think when we are creating, we are giving this piece a life force. So it's a blessing, because I don't take my breath for granted.
Is that the art spirit, the creative spirit we're talking about? The moment when our life force actually moves into a piece that we're creating?
Without it, without that force, without our breath, we wouldn't be able to do it. So it's life, it's breath, it's energy, it's thought, it's prayer. I mean, it's something that doesn't just happen. You know, we've been brought up all our lives since we were children in a certain way, in a certain culture, being taught in our languages, in ceremony, in songs, we have prayer. And I think in our lifetime, it's unfolding. And in this time, you know, after many, many years, you know, this is the piece I'm doing and that's the title. But it didn't just happen now. It's a whole lifetime of an unfolding.
This one is called Having Faith. It's kind of like letting go and trusting. It's just like try just to let go, you know, and not worry and just like somehow to have that faith. I love this space. I just think it's so beautiful. The gold is 22 karat gold leaf. I wanted to do a piece that would have a very gentle flight, because all the pieces that I see that are done of eagles are always very intense, and this is very gentle. It takes a lot of time because I'm into finding balance and grace. You know, it should be flowing and graceful, you know. If you're an eagle, then I hope you have a graceful flight. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a woman, I hope you can walk graceful. It's just sort of how you walk in life. Because I work in this clay, you can see how I kind of move these feathers up so they kind of have a flow. And I like that opportunity to be able to move the clay, press it down. And working in this clay allows me to do that. In stone, once you take it away, it's gone.
The woman standing in Largo, in the DC eagle, golden eagle, with those together is working very nicely. And why? Because sometimes we stuck things, sort of we can't let go. I have to have this. Well, this is mine. We hold it because he's so mean to me that we can't let go. You know, some people.
But when you let it go, and then it's like an eagle to me. It's like sort of you have wings to be free yourself, to flow. And you don't maybe don't have wings, but you have inner wings to free yourself. It's the most beautiful way I see these pieces.
You mentioned freedom, being free. I think when we're children, you know, we're very free, we're young, we don't have a lot of responsibility. But I think as we become adults and we have our own children and we have our responsibilities, sometimes I feel we aren't as free as we used to be, aren't as spontaneous, we're not as, you know, just carefree. And I think as artists, we have to really be careful that we don't lose that. You know, it's almost like a childlike nature of expression. You know, we shouldn't get so rigid in how we want things. You know, we have to be flexible to kind of go with the moment.
Does this entail a practice? Because there are a lot of negative forces in the world that really don't want us to be creative. There are forces that say, let's keep things the way they are. But have you had to have a practice where you learn to trust this creative spirit that comes out in your painting?
I think it's not up to Buddha or teacher or anyone. So really, it's up to you to make your difference in your life. But you need the confidence in clear a vision and trust. So when you have that with the faith, the path of enlightenment or path of awakening is connect with your heart so you can just follow in. But it's important to do exercise like Tai Chi or yoga or and then sort of meditation and just sort of relaxing, sort of breathing. Because today in America, we have a big problem because we sit in the office, we sit in the car, sit in the sofa, go to bed, type twice, so we get so many problems creating in health. So that's why we need to move and breathe in sort of stretches and movements. Each person has a job to create in the right consciousness in this moment to positive energy to the world. Most people, they forget the moment and always sort of looking for something further, but we don't have further, we don't know next moment.
Mani Padme Hum, mantra of compassion.
Bye.
Bye.
Nothing is forever. Everything is impermanent. It's important to not touch to things.
Letting go of our attachments, chasing dreams, you know, that maybe we don't really need like too many things. As I get older, I find that I want less. I don't want so much. So because I think it weighs you down, and maybe something you bought 20 years ago no longer serves you. It doesn't give you the joy or it doesn't speak to you anymore. But maybe somebody else walks in your home and they love it. So give it away.
I know some people, some ladies have 300 shoes. You only 2 feet.
Yeah. It's time to give it away, you know.
I think it's simple, it's important.
I'd like to go back to another theme from the film clip when you said it takes courage to let go. What are we trying to let go of?
Sometimes we are hanging on to an old belief system. We hang on to old emotions, memories, maybe how we were raised, maybe traditional techniques. But as you are growing in this time and this age, you find new ways to express yourself. That's what I mean about letting go. And somehow, and I think we all know what we have to do, you know, individually. We know what has to change and how we need to move to grow in a better way.
In my own work, I've noticed that if my ego gets in the way, if I'm thinking about success, money, fame, and so on, I can't really write. I can't do my art. So the Buddhist notions about moving the ego, putting it in its place, have helped me a lot. Can you describe this process, Lama, in your own work about letting go and surrender?
Yes, very easy and very simple. And you know, it's nothing is forever. Everything is impermanent. And look in our history. All the famous great kings, scholars, right now it's only stories and books. What happened there is impermanence.
Well, it's a very humbling perspective. The answer was the gift. Thank you. It's a good chance for us to look at another film clip about you and your work.
Thank you.
Yes.
This painting is called The Mothers, a symbol of peace. In Tibetan, we say the first human language is Ma. It doesn't matter English or Chinese or Tibetan, always start with the Ma or Ma, Mother, Mothers. Ma sound is the first sound. Therefore, when I paint this, I was thinking about, I painted Dara in the center. Dara is a manifestation of wisdom and compassion. They're called Mother of all the Buddhas, because all the Buddhas born and manifested from the wisdom and compassion. Dara has seven eyes, and they're watching always. And also, she's standing in the Mother Earth. And this all rise from the rainbows with the Mother Earth. And also she says, she comes again and again to this world. After that, she comes back as different female forms. Now, I believe all the female goddesses in this world is Dara manifestations. So then Asia, it's like the Kuan is so big in Asia, I put in the Kuan Yin, the Mother. And then in the West, Mother Mary is the mother of Jesus. And then I saw in some paintings a black Madonna from different countries. And then in the Native Americans always talk about the corn mother. So it doesn't matter which religion or which group, we all live in the Mother Earth.
To me, is the mother's the most important person in the world. Your mother, the one carry you inside 9 months and carry in her body. And then she cleanses you everything, all these three things, bed you and teach you and feed you. And she really just sort of watching you growing. Always there for you. Mother has unconditional love for their child.
I think it's a universal language of love and compassion that all mothers have. All mothers feel, I think, the same. We speak the same language. So it doesn't matter what culture we come from.
You know, we have similar cultures, Tibetans and natives here, and always I see native people, I feel like so connected with my own people. So, and also there's the similar large things. So I've enjoyed to exploring your work and knowing you.
I remember when I lived in India and we were in Darjeeling and in Kathmandu, and going to the Tibetan refugee camps. I was very young, maybe 18 or 19, many years ago. And when I came to the the caps, and I saw the Tibetan people in the other side of the world. I felt like they were my family. I felt like I came home, and I felt very like I was a part of them, like my family was waiting. And so all the time when I see Tibetan people, I feel like they're my relatives. They're my relatives.
Same way I have feelings, because the first time I went to another place in Detroit, first of all, I'm going there, it was like, why I'm going, just like, I'm not comfortable going there. But when I see we build together this fire and doing the ceremony, and then together, and then the altar, the who's the medicine man comes and give me a hug and crying. He said, "Welcome, brother." And that moment just touches my heart. And in a few days I'm staying there, and I'm leaving. It was just so hard for me to sort of leave in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of, I'm saying, okay, I'm not saying goodbye. I'm going to say, see you soon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In our culture, we don't have a word for goodbye. There's no goodbye, because we always will see each other again.
Yeah, we say long life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a goodbye. So tsering. In Tibetan, say tsering means long life.
That's a wonderful grace note with which to end our conversation on the creative spirit. I want to thank you, Estella. I'd like to thank you, Lama, for joining us here on Global Spirit for this exploration of creativity, art, and the sacred.
Hello, I'm still John Cleese, and I do hope that you're enjoying this unique series as much as I am, and I trust you will join us again soon for another episode of Global Spirit, the first internal travel series.
Okay, we're going to do some music now, everybody. Let's see if I can find the right place for this. Okay, just a minute.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome to the White House for the latest in our series celebrating the music that has shaped our American story. And as someone who always shares this house with brilliant, creative, talented, somewhat stubborn women, I think Women's History Month is the perfect time to honor a few more, the women of soul. This is a really good lineup. And I want to thank our performers for this evening. They are fantastic. We've got Tessa Ann Chin here. We've got Melissa Etheridge. We've got Aretha Franklin. We've got Ariana Grande. Miss Patti LaBelle. Janelle Monáe. And Miss Jill Scott. I can't wait. Finally, I want to make a quick public service announcement. When Aretha Franklin first walked into Fame Studio in 1967, most of the other musicians had never heard her sing live before. When they did, one of them said, "The floors rumbled."
and the walls shook. My brain shook. It was magic. So my advice to everyone tonight is simple. Hang on. The Queen of Soul is in the building. If she blows your mind, it'll be okay. But that's what soul music does. It makes us move, and it makes us feel. To quote Jill Scott, soul music is about reaching and touching people on a human level. For many of the performers here tonight, it all began on Sunday morning. Growing up in Detroit, Aretha sang at her father's church and recorded her first album at that church when she was just 14 years old. Patti LaBelle was painfully shy. I cannot believe that, but this is what I have been told. Until she sang a solo in front of the congregation and got a standing ovation. That's when she realized she could do something special. Aretha had already won 11 Grammys by the time Janelle Monáe was born. But as a teenager struggling to make it in New York, Janelle worked as a maid, singing for the other women as they cleaned houses together. And she says the experience inspired her to write music for people like them, because they need it the most. And ultimately, that's what soul is all about, telling some truth. And tonight, we're in for a healthy dose of truth from some of the finest voices there are. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce a true American treasure, the one and only, Miss Patti LaBelle.
Mr. President, Mrs. Obama, I would like to say thank you for the 5 years that you've been in this wonderful house. You have taken us places that no one has taken us in many, many years. Somewhere over the rainbow. Thank you. Somewhere. Bluebirds fly, there's a light that I heard of once. Thank you.
up inside. Oh, girl, over the rain, over the rain, over the rain.
I want to say thank you so much for having me here tonight. Tonight I'm just privileged to share this stage with two legends, Miss Aretha Franklin, Miss Patti LaBelle. Both of them have had a significant influence on all of us here. And for me, I'm just happy, honestly, just to watch, to listen, and to learn. There's another artist who I also love, like Miss Franklin and Miss LaBelle. She owns every song she sings. Her name is Shirley Bassey. And you just might know this song.
To enter his web of senses, but don't go in. The only words he will pump in your ears, but his lies can disguise what you fear. Beware of his heart of gold. This heart is cold. Yes, how will he go? Oh, he goes. He loves gold. Yes, how will he go?
Ladies and gentlemen, two-time Grammy Award winner, Melissa Etheridge.
Let me tell you, You know, when it comes to soul music and rock and roll, okay, from the same tree, absolutely, ever since Elvis Presley heard Little Richard, rock and roll was born out of that. So I'm going to play you a little rock and roll song, one that I know, and show you the roots of rock and roll, rock and soul, as I like to call it.
Please, baby, can't you see that my mind's a burning hell? Like a razor's a ripping and tearing and stripping my heart apart as well. Tonight you told me that you wait for something new. Someone, a woman, is looking like something that might be good for you. Hey. Go on and hold her till the screaming is gone. Go on, believe her when she tells you nothing's wrong.
Mrs. Obama, it's a tremendous honor for me to be here tonight. Growing up in a family of musicians in Jamaica, there was never a time that I wasn't exposed to music of all kinds, including the great female artists of our time. Though I never saw her in person, the music of Miss Donna Summer was always a part of my life, and my parents made sure of that. She was a remarkable singer with an amazing voice, and I am thrilled to perform this in her honor tonight at the White House.
Last dance, last my last chance. Romance tonight. Oh, I need you by me, beside me to guide you. It's lonely, 'cause when I'm dead, I'm so sorry. So it's my last chance for romance tonight. Oh, you mean
room this is. Ladies and gentlemen, Aretha Franklin is the essence of freedom. When I was a child and I heard that voice and washing dishes or vacuuming or whatever it is that my mother made me do, to hear that voice allowed me a certain level of freedom. It's a soul glow. So tonight, in honor of that and of that incredible woman, I'm going to be singing one of her songs. You can sing along if you want to.
Side to side. Sit yourself down in the car and take a ride. Mr. President, Mrs. Obama, what's up? How are you? Good to see you. It's good. It's all good? All right, good. So thank you for having me. I'm going to sing a song by a woman who's inspired me endlessly since I was a little girl, and I'm going to sing I Have Nothing by Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
that do. So they treated me in all the shadows. I couldn't do the show fast. Well, baby, you know that I was the sweetest man. And you never had, you know what I'm saying? Never kiss me once again. Push your hand and say what they want.
You can't get too high, you can't get too low. This song is called Tightrope. Hit it, man!
Some people talk about it, they know all about you. When you get down, they doubt you. And you get tipping on the scene, yeah, they talk about it. Cause they can't tip on the scene, what you talk about it. Talk about it. When you get elevated, they love it or they hate it. You get to form the papers, keep getting foggy on the scene while they jumping like it. They trying to take all of your dreams, but you can't allow. Cause baby, whether I'm high or low, baby, whether I'm high or low, I got to own the title. On alligators and little rattlesnakes, but I'm on other people's fighting like a Terminator. Ain't no equivocating, I fight for what I don't believe. Why you talking about it? Why you keep telling me? Some call me a sinner, some call me a sinner. I'm calling you to dinner and you know exactly what I mean. Yeah, I'm talking about it. You get right or you get me.
Oh, 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 oh
would you please welcome back one of R&B's golden voices, Jill Scott.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back. I'm taking my freight out, pulling it off the shelf, putting it on my chain, getting out my bed, taking my freedom, putting it in my car, wherever I choose to go, yeah, I'm gonna take this for a ride. I'm holding on to my freedom, can't take it from me. I was born into it, it comes naturally. I'm in my own freedom, playing the Lord in me, representing his glory.
To be here in the White House in the presence of so many incredible women. Honestly, I'm telling you, I have had to pinch myself like 5 times already just to make sure this is real. And it is. Tonight, we've heard from the Queen of Soul, Miss Aretha Franklin, and the Godmother of Soul from Philadelphia, Miss Patti LaBelle. And I would like to suggest that we pay homage to the rock and roll queen, Miss Tina Turner. Is that all right? So, with the help of our musical director for this evening, Greg Fillinganes. Let's go rolling on the rubber. This makes a change of law.
Left up the job in the city, working for the man every night and day. And I never lost 1 minute of sleep. Been worrying about the way things might have been. Big wheel keep on turning.
Come on up here, girl.
Fire never keep on burning. And we're rolling, yeah. We're rolling on the river. Oh, I cleaned a lot of plates down in Memphis.
Melissa, ask yourself.
I pumped a lot of paint down in New Orleans. But I never saw the good side of the city now, till I hitched a ride on the riverboat queen. You know, big wheels keep on turning.
Entirely appropriate for us to end with the Queen of Soul. Please welcome back to the stage Ms. Aretha Franklin.
show online in its entirety, plus web-exclusive performances by Melissa Etheridge, Ariana Grande, and an extended version of Amazing Grace, go to pbs.org/whitehouse. Corporate support for Women of Soul in performance at the White House is provided by Pepsi in recognition of Pepsi's Conversations Project, a series.
No fiat currency can. Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Euripides once said, "No fiat currency can confidently say that it will be living tomorrow." I paraphrase, of course. Euripides, Stacy, what's this all about?
Well, Max, the U.S. dollar may be shuffling off this mortal coil if the J.P. Morgan chart here, titled "Your Reserve Currency Status Does Not Last Forever," starting from 1400, we had the Portugal as a reserve currency, then Spain, Netherlands, France, Britain, and now the U.S. The U.S. has outlasted the Netherlands so far and is about the equal to Portugal.
Wow. Okay, so the U.S. dollar is ready to hit bite the dust, is that what you're saying?
If history is prologue, if it is able to predict anything, of course, in investment terms, they always say that past never can predict the future, so we don't know, but it is ready for a big earthquake.
Okay, so, well, we've been saying this for years, and so J.P. Morgan agrees. So J.P. Morgan is finally waking up. Did they watch our show? Is that it?
Well, I don't know if they're predicting it, but they're just saying it is at about, it's a very ripe currency. So this chart, however, featured heavily in quite a few analysis about this latest story. 40 central banks are betting this will be the next reserve currency. At least 40 central banks have invested in the yuan, and several others are preparing to do so, putting the mainland currency on the path to reserve status even before full convertibility. This is Standard Chartered, and the yuan is obviously the currency of China. And they're saying the fact that despite it not being convertible, all of these central banks around the world, at least 40, stocking up on reserves of it, makes it a de facto reserve currency.
Right. Well, I understand why central banks would be stocking up on the yuan, because now you've got this whole new trading zone, Eurasia trading zone, which is China, Russia, Iran, and they're going to be pricing oil in this new, you know, basket of currencies. So people, you know, these countries obviously need oil to fuel their economy. So it makes prudent sense to stock up on yuan.
Well, of course, people could be looking at that J.P. Morgan chart, looking at history and saying, well, the U.S. dollar is about ready to go bye-bye, so let's position ourselves for the possible future. But not quite yet. The U.S. dollar is still the world's most widely held reserve currency, accounting for nearly 33% of global foreign exchange holdings at the end of last year, according to IMF data. That ratio has been declining since 2000, when 55% of the world's reserves were denominated in U.S. dollars. So the trend is not the dollar's friend.
Yeah, you know, it's like when you have shampoo, and as you get down halfway through the shampoo bottle or a quarter, three quarters, you put water in there to try to stretch it out. Now, the U.S. dollar has been world reserve currency for decades, but it is losing its efficacy to cleanse the world's global banking system through the money laundering or a shampoo job. So they keep adding more kind of quantitative easing or other accounting tricks to kind of keep it going. But it's being hollowed out, isn't it? It's not really fit for purpose.
Well, at the moment, it's an exorbitant privilege, as Charles de Gaulle's government called it, that it's an exorbitant privilege to be able to print money and just get goods and services from around the world sent to you pretty much for free. So that on that one hand, in the real world, in the real economy, with real GDP and real global trade, it could end up hurting the U.S. However, there's another angle to the story where Eve Smith at NakedCapitalism.com, she looks at the same data about the central banks around the world, the 40 of them that we know of at least, stocking up on yuan. And she disagrees with the likes of, say, Zero Hedge, who think it's very important and the signal of the end of the dollar, because she says reserve currency is the yuan tearing down the U.S. dollar. Well, she says there is a quantum difference between central banks holding a few of your pennies and global markets pricing absolutely everything in relative terms off your currency. The U.S. dollar still makes up one side of 90% of the world's $700 trillion in over-the-counter forex, equity, commodity, interest rate, and credit derivative transactions, making the yuan and everything else almost completely irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like one of those Russian dolls, isn't it? Where you open it up and there's another doll, and then you open it up again, it's another doll, and you keep going, and it's all dollars, dollars, dollars! Yes, well, she makes a good point. All of the $700 trillion or so in global derivatives market price in dollars. So the subset of various currencies would be less important, according to Eve Smith. But I disagree with Eve Smith, because she is not taking on board the trend of the economy moving from paper to assets. So if we move to assets, as we are, with the oil pipelines coming into play now in this Eurasian trading zone, then paper will be revealed as not really having much value at all. And so, therefore, we're going to see more pricing of trade in hard commodities like oil, like gas, like gold. And that's what China, Russia, Iran are getting ready to do right now. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is all about that. And they're getting ready to throw down in a big way. So I have to disagree with Eve. I think Eve's being fooled by the nominal value of the big number.
However, in the real world as well, okay, you have a $70 trillion at most dollar economy. It produces $70 trillion in global goods and services every year. So the U.S., effectively, they own 10 times that, the next 10 years of growth that has to be sent essentially back to the U.S. And you saw this during the collapse of 2008. Here we have Europe, where people work for a living. They're at more than just the manufacturing jobs of flipping burgers. So people actually have wealth-creating jobs. Look at Germany. Look at France. Everybody has jobs. They make things. They have lifestyles, houses. They have no mortgage on it. They have retirement benefits. They have all these things. They create wealth and goods and services. And yet they suffered far more than the U.S. because what happened? A lot of the derivatives blew up. A lot of the derivatives and all, what happened? The European banks, the European economies had to convert their euros into dollars and send them in to close off these trades with JP Morgan and all the U.S. banks which hold these U.S. dollar-based derivatives.
That's absolutely right. And that's why as the U.S. market for derivatives continues to collapse, you're going to see more countries moving toward asset-based exchange and currency swaps based on currencies that have a tie to resources like oil and gas. Remember, 1971, the world went on the petrodollar when America defaulted on its bonds. And this has been going on for 40 years. And now we're at a new juncture where the U.S. is defaulting on all of the quantitative easing that they put out there. So now we're going to go for essentially the second stage of the petrodollar, except it won't be oil for dollars. It'll be oil for rubles, oil for Chinese yuan. It'll be the petro yuan. The petro yuan is coming to replace the petrodollar. That's what I'm saying. That's why Eve Smith is wrong. She doesn't understand the petro yuan.
Yes, well, okay, but I still reckon those contracts, those financialized contracts, when they have to be either declared odious debt, fraudulent debts, and
okay, so
not-
take that side for a second. Number one, who goes out of business? J.P. Morgan. They got $90 trillion in fake derivative nonsense that they share with the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve goes bankrupt. They're leveraged at 90 to 1. Who else? Bank of America, Citibank, all those U.K. banks, HSBC, Barclays, Lloyds, they're all hugely leveraged with this paper nonsense. They all go bust. What, do the people still need to buy gas? Do the people need to buy oil? Why do you think Russia is sitting there just like nodding their head like this, like, go, you know, bring it on. We've got the gas. You've got paper, you idiots.
So let's look at other signs out there and the headlines that, in fact, the U.S. dollar might be at the end of its reserve status as J.P. Morgan looks back to 1400 and every single empire seems mighty and indestructible, and yet their empires collapse and the dollars collapse. Gazprom's oil arm considers moving away from dollar-based contracts in response to U.S. sanctions.
What did I just say? It's Gazprom. They're moving away from the dollar. Gazprom is so huge. They're like the freaking giant of oil companies.
Gazprom Neft, the oil arm of Russia's Gazprom, is one considering doing this. The company is the first in Russia's oil sectors to say it could potentially move away from dollar-based contracts in response to Western sanctions, and marks the planning going on in Russian industry to anticipate possible further measures. So the CEO says no such task has been set by the government, but we have discussed with our buyers the possibility of switching contracts to euros, and 95% said they are ready. So, of course, this is another way to destroy the derivatives, those $700 trillion in U.S.-denominated derivatives, because if the underlying contract is now based in euros or yuan or ruble, then, of course, there's a risk for the J.P. Morgan holding those derivatives, which is the underlying contract is in another currency.
Well, you know, J.P. Morgan recently cut off Russia from a $5,000 money transfer, and they started create, warlike situation on top of the additional financial warlike boycotts and interferences that J.P. Morgan's been involved with. So J.P. Morgan has effectively declared war on Russia. And here you have the CEO of Gazprom saying we might start pricing out of dollars. If you don't understand the subtext of what this gentleman is saying, you're about to have a very, very cold winter.
But again, the signs of the end are when the entire system, the fabric that they control, the U.S. controls the financialized world, and therefore the derivatives, the hundreds of trillions of dollars of derivatives and debt upon which the
here's
are,
my bill for the lint. According to E. Smith, this is worth $30 billion. Look, I collateralized my belly button lint for $30 billion. That's right there on J.P. Morgan's balance sheet. It must be true that a loaning against it, according to the Basel III agreement, this fulfills our minimum capital requirements. I saw Billy Brown Lynn. It's $30 billion in assets. Those are tier one assets, buddy. What do you mean gas and oil? Nobody wants that stuff.
So as part of measures to try to increase the economy's independence from international forces, Russia speeded up the development of a domestic payment system and has urged companies to increase the share of ruble payments and contracts with foreign partners. So they're developing new systems that are outside. Forget the derivatives, okay? They're gone. How about the credit cards, the whole financial system, SWIFT, the transfer of money from point A to point B? Once you start using that as a weapon, then, of course, they're going to come up with their own alternative weapons.
Duh! Of course they're going to come up with their own alternative credit card systems and SWIFT systems and money transfer systems. Of course they're going to... China, Russia, Iran, the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, look it up, get educated. I mean, this is the nexus of power going forward against the paper derivative nonsense that encompasses the UK, the US, and their allies.
So, and finally, of course, one thing that is another sign that this is the end of this empire is not only do you have the students here, the numbers just came out that students here, 73% of college students, university students, will still be in debt in their 50s. They'll still be paying their student debts there. But over in China, a tweet from Yanis Varoufakis says China invested $5 trillion in 2013, more than the U.S. and Europe combined, a datum to concentrate the mine. So they're investing for the future. The U.S., the West are not investing for the future. In fact, they're more bombing and getting rid of all the evidence of their own empires.
Good point. Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Max.
All right, stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to investor, author, Dr. Jerome Booth, who is also the author of the new book, Emerging Markets in an Upside Down World. Jerome, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jerome, over the past year, there's been a stampede out of emerging markets. Your thoughts?
Well, I wouldn't call it a stampede. I would call it a little bit of nerves. And I think what we have to understand is that in today's world, emerging market central banks own about 80% of global reserves. So they're the net creditors. So if some Western investors at the margin move in and out and the central banks don't do anything, then you get volatility. And you get this impression...
Let me just cut you off right there because we're going to unpack this a little bit. So 80% of world reserves are owned by emerging market banks.
Yes, and central banks.
Yeah. And in this category, we would put China.
Yes. Yeah.
And who else?
Well, there are about 20 with
Russia.
Significant Russia, Brazil. There are 70 emerging markets in the, or nearly 70 just in the debt index.
Okay. So these are emerging markets.
Lots of countries.
80% of their central banks own the global reserve.
Yeah.
Which is important to reemphasize that, because in other words, they're the net creditors of this.
They are the net creditors, and we've had a, we've got an international monetary system which arguably doesn't work, and it's sort of failed to work spectacularly in 1971 for very similar reasons, where you had the big creditor countries, in that case Europe, really called the shots. And when the US came off convertibility to gold, it sank from $35 to $194 by 74. So the idea that, you know, we're in a, just because you don't get volatility, just because you haven't had a big reaction to these global imbalances yet, doesn't mean it's going to happen. And I think what's important to recognize is that the creditors...
What sank?
The dollar sank.
Against what index?
Against gold. So against gold, which was the previous measure. Now, other countries in the 70s also had a complete chaos, and we had a decade of inflation to erode the debt. But the point is, we are being complacent if we think that there aren't risks like that with the global monetary system today. And the basic problem leading up to 08 was a combination of poor management, poor regulation of banks, plus... this massive move of savings from the emerging world, which have big savings rates, into investing in the developed world. And that pushed down the whole US yield curve and created this idea that there was very, very low risk, and that led to this huge leverage. And we're still in a world where we're trying to work through that deleveraging. And part of that rebalancing at some point will be actually the emerging currencies coming up. In the meantime, they're sort of waiting. And if we see a few Western investors come in and out of emerging markets, we shouldn't think that that's actually the whole story. There's a thing I call core periphery disease. This is the idea, and I call it a disease because it's a very deep-seated meme or intellectual virus, been with us a couple of hundred years. And the basic premise of core periphery is that the core, the developed world, affects the periphery, the emerging markets, but we ignore the effect the other way around. So, for example, there was an IMF report just after 08, which asked the question, how much money might leave emerging markets if there's another big problem in, say, Greece? And they came up with an answer, $15 billion. May sound like a lot of money. Core periphery disease is not asking the question the other way around, because the moment you ask the question the other way around, you realize that $11 trillion owned by emerging market central banks and sovereign wealth funds, invested in the so-called liquid, just the sovereign bonds of Europe and the US, could leave going the other way. That's two orders of magnitude. Money might flow the other way. And history from 71 and prior episodes show us that that's exactly something that can happen in a catastrophic way. So when we think about risk, and we think, you know, we've got this part of core periphery disease is thinking that we're safe. We even talk about things like risk-free, which is an abuse of language. There's no such thing as a risk-free investment. All there is investments where the risk isn't priced or isn't perceived. And emerging market risk is arguably over-perceived. So we have this traditional view that some emerging market is something we invest into and out of in a sort of very peripheral, you know, way to get a bit of extra return for a bit of extra risk now and then, tactically. And actually, that's not the world we live in. The world we live in is one where the macroeconomic powers have shifted, the bargaining powers have shifted, the emerging markets are now 85% of the world's population, 50% of economic activity on the planet, and they are the ones without the massive amounts of debt, without the big sort of macroeconomic problems of deleveraging, which we're going to be faced with in the West for, you know, another couple of decades.
Okay, well, in the emerging markets, they got 80% of the reserves. That means that the so-called top-tier markets got 20% of the reserves.
Yeah.
But they've got 80 to 90% of the debt, in other words. In other words, the market making and the price discovery is being done by these highly indebted countries. And what you're saying is that at some point there's a rebalancing that's cooked into the books here, or baked into the cake, where suddenly things like assets are meaningful and debt is no longer driving the global economy because people start to default on that debt. And you get back to the 1971 as an example, and I just want to touch on 1971, yeah, for example, because very few people bring that into the conversation, and you're making a direct analogy to 71, because 71, the U.S. had enormous debt racked up during the Vietnam War, and then in 1971, in August, they closed the gold window and essentially defaulted on their debt.
Yes.
So you're seeing parallel between that moment and now.
Correct? I'm actually saying that what happened in August 71 is that the US didn't have a choice. Nixon didn't have a choice. Either he could have, if you like, defaulted then and kept the gold, which is what he did, or he would have run out of gold and then defaulted. So what I'm saying is the bargaining power actually rested with the creditor countries. And likewise, so I'm saying two things. Today, one, the bargaining power is now with the net creditors who are emerging markets. And B, when you look at risk, you shouldn't ignore that. You should realize that, like, you know, most investors care a lot more about a large permanent loss than a bit of volatility. So when we've got when we think about risk in that broader sense, then we realize that actually there's a lot of risk in the developed countries, and there's actually risk, yes, that I'm not saying emerging markets aren't risky, but it's priced in. And I think, yes, we had inflation in the 70s. When we had debt after the Second World War, we had financial repression. Those are the two sort of main mechanisms of eroding debt over time.
Okay, in 1971, the gold window was closed, but we went on the petrodollar.
Yes.
So petroleum became really the prima facie of the world. This is the currency of the world. And we've been living in this world for 40 years plus. And we're at a stage in history, in geopolitical history, where seemingly countries like Saudi Arabia, Russia, these other countries, the BRICS, so-called, they're now looking to get out of this petrodollar to some degree. You're talking about China, Iran, and Russia possibly doing a Eurasia trading zone, getting out of the petrodollar completely. So they're in the position to call the shots, similar to what you're saying is in 1971. The U.S. wasn't calling the shots. They had no choice. They had to close the gold window. Now the U.S. is wringing their hands. What should we do? What should we do? But if I follow what you're saying here, these other countries are going to call the shots. They're the ones who are calling the tune. They're the ones who are going to establish going forward.
I think actually, yes, and that's a very, very productive line of argument, because what you saw, of course, was the focus very much on oil in 71 and the early 70s, and then again later in the 70s. And since then, it's become commodities more generally. And what's happening today is today, emerging markets are price makers in commodity markets. Tomorrow, when our pensions will be, things will be drawing, in 20 years, say, they'll actually be price makers in a lot of basic goods as well. And this has dramatic implications for savers today in the West.
Basic goods, meaning consumer goods?
Okay, say in 20 years, you're going to retire, you want to draw your pension. What you actually want is not $2,000 a month or £2,000 a month. That might buy a loaf of bread, because we might have had inflation. What you actually want is the ability to purchase goods and services. So let's take cars, for example. In 20 years, maybe cars are going to be, 90% of cars in the world are going to be produced in emerging markets, and 90% are going to be sold in emerging markets. And that means that the price of a car is going to be internationally determined, insofar as you don't have protectionism, and it's going to be determined by emerging market economic factors.
Okay.
And that means that if your pension fund doesn't invest in emerging markets today, it's fundamentally not meeting its liabilities.
So since World War II, really, U.S. dollar has been world reserve currency.
Yeah.
Over the past 15 years or so, the percentage of global trade in U.S. dollars has been diminished. Obviously, commodities like oil are priced only in dollars. If Japan wants to buy oil, they have to buy dollars first, and then they buy.
Yeah, but the economics is not in dollars. It's money illusion to think that the economics.
But my question is the world reserve status of U.S. dollar, is that now on the chopping block?
Yes, I think it is. And it came into conflict, of course, right from the start at Bretton Woods in 1944. There's a thing called the Triffin Dilemma, which we probably haven't got time to go into. But there is a basic conflict in having a central bank, which is central bank to one country and to the world.
But they get the seigniorage, which is the
Triffin Dilemma,
is the U.S., when they never have to pay those debts, because they just issue more and more debt.
That's right.
So this is a huge free ride for the U.S. Now, bottom line, though, is if you have a shift out of the dollar for the U.S. and the U.K., it's going to mean inflation.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Now, what I'm saying is that the international monetary system is not fit for purpose. So we need an international monetary system which is more representative of the global economic activity. We can't go to one other commodity or one other currency, to be honest. We have to go to a multi-currency system, precisely because, you know, South-South trade is now 30% of global trade. You know, it's got nothing to do with the West. And that's growing very, very rapidly. And we need actually to prevent another crisis, to prevent, if you like, the systemic risks that we have of having a very highly concentrated set of nodes in our international monetary as well as financial systems. We need actually to have a much, much more diverse system of
linkages. That's pro-competition.
Yes.
But we live in a world where competition is shunned upon, because the dollar and the banks that deal in dollar in the U.S. and in the U.K. They love their oligopoly in trading derivatives price in dollars. They don't want competing
But they also
currencies.
Know it's good for them to get rid of it, because they'd much prefer, at the end of the day, people, even in the West, would prefer not to have another financial crisis, not to have a depression.
But they
and it means giving
money
up a little bit today in order to get that stability for, you know,
the wealth of the top 1% of top 1% during the crisis doubled and tripled. Why would they not want another crisis? They seem to enjoy, they benefit from these crises quite spectacularly.
Well, fortunately, we live in democracies, and it's not just up to the 1%. It is actually up to the greater stability of these economies, and the wealth of, you know, the middle classes in the developed world.
Well,
I would say are definitely
let me jump in here for a second.
Aligned with emerging markets.
The democratic processes in these countries that are going to get screwed by the shift into the emerging market are not able to vote out the entrenched oligopolies.
One of the good things about
the emerging
trade.
Market yeah. will push in a way that you're describing to a multi-currency
yes.
world because it's in their interest. But the bankers in the City of London are not going to say, you know, it's in the world's interest. We're going to go to a multi-currency world. We want unicorns to come out and, you know.
No, this is not about, this is not obviously simplistic, but it is about bargaining power. It is about the fact that people, there is a positive sum game out of more trade. And the point is, we have a complete distortion of international capital at the moment. My whole book actually is about...
By design, though. It's not by an accident.
No, it is by accident. If we've got poor finance theory, we can do a lot better, and it's to the benefit of people in the developed and the developing countries.
In the context of all the rigging scandals of LIBOR, Forex, yep. oil, gold, and it's all centralized rigging for a few benefit, how can you make the case that it's an accident? But anyway, we're running out of time. This has been a scintillating conversation. We'll have to have you on again soon. I wanted to get into talking about the cement countries, not the bricks or the mix.
Yes. Countries in emerging markets excluded by new terminology.
Well, we're out of time, though. So we have to say goodbye. Jerome Booth, thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
My pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, author, and investor, Dr. Jerome Booth. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
Okay, just a second. I guess I do want to play one more thing here. I want to go back to Amy. Yeah, that's what I want to do. I forgot. And finish that piece. I backed it up just a little bit. Let's do that. Okay. Okay, here we go.
Easy. All you got to do is turn into Democracy Now! Every morning, and you realize what's going on. The second part of the meat of the book, and we can talk about this in a second, but it's got 20 chapters on everything you can imagine, every institution in this society, and how it would be different if we didn't have capitalism. And the last part of the book are 6 essays on how we get from where we are to where we want to be, how to make that transformation. And your essay, Juan, I have to say, it's a book full of wisdom, not the least of which is your essay on immigrants and the role that they'll play in that transformation. But in any case, in a word, Paul LeBlanc writes, he's a historian, and he wrote one of the chapters on how to transform it. He says, socialism involves people taking control of their own lives, shaping their own futures, and together controlling the resources that make such freedom possible. Socialism will come to nothing if it's not a movement of the great majority in the interest of the great majority. People can only become truly free through their own efforts. That's a good Passover message, by the way. That's our definition of socialism. It's true democracy.
Francis, one of the most striking essays, there were many in the book, was the one by Mumia and Angela Davis on the prison industrial complex. First of all, how did you manage to put together that collaboration between the two of them, one incarcerated and one traveling around the world, and also the importance of that particular essay?
Well, it was easy because Angela Davis was a supporter of Mumia's freedom, so they were not unknown to each other. Also, she wrote a book about the end of prisons, so it was a natural for us to, it was not easy because he's in prison, she's free. They had to collaborate by stuff going back and forth. It was very complicated. But what they came up with was an entirely different approach to how we deal with so-called crime. And it's more like was done by Native Americans when they had people which broke laws, who broke laws. And they were tried, so to speak, by their peers, by their mothers and fathers and doctors and chiefs, etc., who embarrassed them in front of the community and made them feel bad about what they had done and what they could do to overcome their crime. So it was done, it was called the commons. It was done by the community, in the community, for the community. And that's why she says, get rid of prisons. Just have local tribunals where the people who know this person, man or woman, can put them on the right track. It's revolutionary, but makes a lot of sense, because our prison system locks up millions of people who've never committed a crime in their life, the prime one being Mumia Abu-Jamal, who never killed anybody. And the woman who's grieving her departed husband should grieve for the person who really killed the guy and not for Mumia, who had nothing to do with that murder, and who has incidentally become one of the leading intellectuals in the United States. And I am now working on his seventh book, and all of his books have been in print for 30 years, and every one of them remains in print and continues to sell.
In January, we interviewed Kshama Swant, one of the few socialists to hold elected office in the country. She's an economics teacher and former Occupy Wall Street activist who was elected to Seattle's city council after she ran in a campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We asked Swant why she decided to run as a socialist.
The important thing about running as a socialist is, you know, for one, to show that there is a definite openness for clear alternatives, not only to the big business parties, but the system that they represent, the capitalist system. And if you look at recent polls, they show that people, especially young people, are much more open to socialism than you would find out from the corporate media. People are also fed up with the political dysfunction.
That is the new socialist city, Seattle City Council member, Kshama Swant, Michael Smith. And also, as we wrap up, because we have less than a minute right now, when people say you choose democracy or you choose capitalism, the contradiction in that.
Capitalism is incompatible with democracy. Fascism is compatible with capitalism, but not democracy and capitalism don't go in. We can see that trend. We did a book, Michael Ratner wrote the introduction on Bill Kunstler's writings, one of the founders of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we called it the emerging police state. And people said, well, it's a little over the top, you know, but it's exactly what's happening. And as Juan points out in his chapter, we either develop some socialist leadership and build a left-wing alternative here, or we're going to have fascism. That's the direction things are going in. So imagine living in a socialist USA will help people get from where we are to where we want to be.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Frances Golden, literary agent. She was the literary agent for Adrienne Rich. She's for Barbara Kingsolver, Mumia Abu-Jamal, housing actress for over 60 years. And she will be turning 90. I understand it. We were making you a little older than you were in June. And so we wish you a happy pre-birthday. Michael Smith, thanks so much for being with us as well. Co-editors of Imagine, Living in a Socialist USA. That does it for the broadcast, yes?
Brooklyn Folk Festival, weekend after next in Brooklyn.
We'll let people know. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
That was a nice positive thing to look at. I've got piles of papers here about things that are not so pretty. Let's just put them all in the pile. There is one that we'll look at it another day. It's called Seeds of Destruction, the Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. And it goes, I'm just going to read a few paragraphs just so you get the drift, because it's also extraordinarily important to be aware of things like this and not just be slightly aware. The last three or four years, this is from globalresearch.ca. And then there's a / and there's a hyphen between every word. Seeds of Destruction, the Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. And then there's another hyphen at the end. 2/9379. The last 3 or 4 years have been a number of books, documentaries, and articles on the dangers of genetically modified seeds. Majority has focused on adverse health and environmental impact. Almost none of the geopolitics of GMCs, and particularly seeds as a weapon of mass destruction. Engdahl has addressed this issue, yet the crop seed is one of the many seeds of destruction in this book. Engdahl carefully documents how the intellectual foundations of eugenics, mass culling of the sick, colored and otherwise disposable races, were actually first established and even legally approved in the United States. Eugenics research was financially supported by the Rockefellers and other elite families and first tested on Jews under Nazi Germany. It is purely by chance that world's poorest nations also happen to be best endowed with natural resources. These regions are also the ones with growing populations. The fear among European ruling classes and families increasingly integrating with economic and military might of the United States was that of the poor nations becoming developed. The abundant natural resources, especially oil, gas, and strategic minerals and metals, may become scarcer for the white population. That situation was unacceptable to the white ruling elite. The central question that dominated the minds of the ruling clique was population reduction in resource-rich countries. Yet the question was how to engineer mass culling over all the world without generating powerful backlash, as it was bound to happen. As the United States oil reserves peaked in 1972 and it became a net oil
import.
Whoops.
And so that is something that.
Sorry. Where are you going to. You got to come back quick. Go here if you're going to be, because I need you just to start this. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Sorry. Kissinger was one of the key strategists of Nixon. When the U.S. oil reserves peaked in 1972, and it became a net oil importer, the situation became alarming, and the agenda took the center stage. Kissinger, one of the key strategists of Nixon, nurtured by the Rockefellers, prepared what is known as National Security Study Memo, NSSM number 200, in which he elaborated his plan for population reduction. In his memo, he specifically targeted 13 countries: Bangladesh, Brazil, Colombia, Egypt, Ethiopia, India, Indonesia, Nigeria, Pakistan, Turkey, Thailand, and the Philippines. The weapon to be used was food. Even as there was a famine, food would be used to leverage population reduction. Kissinger is on record for stating, control oil, you control nations, control food, and you control the people. How a small group of key people transformed the elitist philosophy of controlling food to control people into realistic operational possibility within a short time is the backdrop of Engdahl's book, the central theme running from the beginning till the end, with the Rockefellers and Kissinger, among others, as the key dramatis personae. That's good enough, but this is a longer document. We'll get it up there on the internet. Don't take this half-heartedly. I've heard a lot of people say, I can't afford it. I got to get the cheaper food. And it's completely clear. And we've heard enough things now that this causes death. And when you get nutrition in healthy, strong, organic food, you need to eat a lot less. Not just a little less, a lot less. And you don't need all that which is called food, but which is genetically modified, as it is a genocide operation big time. So blessings to all of you. And remember, Dr. Keshi will be taking things right out of the air. There's all kinds of things. So we're going to play this one piece here. It's called The Tesseract, Transformers, and the Cosmic Christ. Let's do that. Okay, here we go.
When at last we see our mirror image through the hypercube, revealed through inner perception, we may fall backwards within ourselves before this universe's own inception. The light may fade and wither weary atop a cosmic funeral dreary, a faint and flicker human path to look beyond the tesseract.
Transformers, more than meets the eye.
Indeed. The AllSpark, a life-creating messiah cube, makes a crash landing into Antarctica. The savior-like Optimus Prime, whose name implies the mathematics of cube geometry, needs to get to the life-giving cube of power before Megatron, or as I will explain, Metatron. His plan is to martyr himself by putting the cube inside of his chest and then self-destructing it if he's unsuccessful at defeating Megatron. He is Optimus Cosmic Christ Prime trying to save humanity from evil, a motif that is saturated in media aimed at children, to further the myth of Christianity and to aid in an entire new generation of religious brainwashing. In the Transformers comic book issue 67, we see more 9/11 tower destruction in an episode that came out 9 years prior to the event. If we consider Newtonian superimposition and time travel a possibility, these little coincidences may not have ever existed if the 9/11 ritual had never happened. The towers might still be intact in another parallel universe, where the color green is red and President Bush's head isn't up his ass. Here we have Cosmic Optimus Christ in his eight-pointed light star, seeking to destroy his creator, darkness, which is exactly what the sun does every day. And like the masterful documentary Zeitgeist states, it's what the Christ figure was based upon, the sun. Metatron is associated with being the voice of God. This voice being a sort of geometry or sacred music from the 10th dimension, creating the cubic fruit of life configuration. In early Kabbalah scriptures, Metatron supposedly forms the cube from his soul. This cube can later be seen in Christian art where it appears on his chest or floating behind him. Metatron's cube is also considered a holy glyph and was often drawn around an object or person to ward off demons and satanic powers. This idea is also present in alchemy, in which the cube is favored as a containment circle or creation circle. The cube resembles the fourth-dimensional analog of the cube, or the tesseract. The sign of the cross is nothing more than the depiction of the sun's precession through the 12 cycles of the zodiac. That's why Jesus is said to have had 12 disciples and is known as the light of the world. Jesus is literally the sun. Like many gods before him, including Horus of Egyptian mythology, all ancient religions were no more and no less a deification of the sun, bringer of illumination, food, and warmth to ancient humans struggling to survive and understand the cosmos on the surface. The famous Dali painting is very relevant here, as it depicts Jesus or the sun crucified on the net of the tesseract, a fourth-dimensional cubic bridge, the underlying concept being that the third-dimensional sun is a martyr for the opening of the fourth dimension, and still remains the savior of mankind as it houses the secrets of time travel and the fourth dimension. Even our clock is separated into the 12 sections of the zodiac. And as we move from the era of Pisces, or the two fish associated with Jesus, and into the age of Aquarius, the water bearer, there will be tumultuous and severe changes in the consciousness of the planet, as well as environmental changes due to the alignment of our solar system with the center of the Milky Way galaxy, a rejuvenating shower of hyper-evolutionary radiation that only occurs every 26,000 years, which will affect and alter human DNA in magnetic and light energy orientation. A lot of us more sensitive beings have already detected the first waves of change through our cosmic third eye parabola, and await the cleansing ocean of galactic fog with open hearts and open minds, an evolution away from ego and materialism into the palace of mirrors and great mystery. Oh, and something for Al Gore? Try solar warming. Our gas-guzzling SUVs don't account for the heat index increases on Mars and Pluto recently cited by astronomers. Mention this to me. Watch the weather change. The Tesseract, or fourth-dimensional cube cross, is referenced in the book A Wrinkle in Time, a children's fantasy novel by Madeline L'Engle, where centaur-like beings act as God's voice, a.k.a. the Metatron, and lead children to the fourth dimension to fight evil forces. Jesus, Buddha, Bach, and Einstein are referenced in the story as well as being protectors of the light. In the movie Cube 2, or Cube Squared, the government places random citizens in a hypercube prison. The only way out is to study the mathematic anomalies, or Optimus Prime numbers, and the patterns of displacement of time in the fourth dimension. The closing sequence of the film, referencing Jesus once again in relation to the hypercube, as the sole survivor is seen walking on water over the bridge of the Tesseract. Stunning, really. Another movie which mentions the Tesseract is The Last Mimsy. In this film, two children are sent a white rabbit from the future that they then have to figure out how to send back into the future via a wormhole created by special toys they find within a Pentagon-encircled hypercube. In doing this, a cosmic time-traveling mandala rips through space-time, and the rabbit is sent home safely. That led me, of course, to Donnie Darko, another time-traveling rabbit wormhole story, in which Donnie opens the Tesseract and peers through the looking glass. See you all on the other side. Change all the horrible things that have taken place and replace them with something better. We'll be right back.
Okay, good, everybody. Okay, I'm going to squeeze in another really quick thing. It's called The Astounding Conspiracy Theories of Wall Street Genius Mark Gorton. This will take me a minute, but I think we should read it. And just put this gentleman in the circle of light, because everything he's got in here tells the whole truth, literally. And that's why they want to take him and his wife and how many, 3-4 children, take them out right now.
Yeah.
So we want to put this dear soul in the circle of support, as that's not a good idea at this time. Nope, not. Mark Gorton is a prominent financier and a respected entrepreneur. He founded the music sharing site LimeWire, and he runs Tower Research, a famed high-frequency trading firm. Gorton also believes that the ruthless secret cabal that assassinated JFK and planned 9/11 could be coming to kill his family. Mark Gorton does not have a reputation as a crackpot. Quite the opposite. He's been favorably profiled in the New York Times for his business acumen and charitable deeds. His experience as the head of LimeWire, which disrupted the music industry and then lost a $100 million lawsuit as a result, was closely followed by the press. And as Michael Lewis's blockbuster new book about high-frequency trading was published recently, prominent media outlets turned to Gorton to learn what high-frequency trading firms were really like. The Huffington Post even dubbed him the new face of Wall Street. He is a very respected and very wealthy man. This week, we were forwarded documents that Gorton was sending out to employees at Tower Research. These documents, embedded at the bottom of this post, are essays by Mark Gorton laying out his theories on the secret high-level murderous criminal cabal that is responsible for, among other things, the JFK and RFK assassinations, the presidential careers of the Bushes, Clintons, and Obama. And yes, they're including Obama. Just remember to put Hillary Clinton and the DuPonts and all the 13 families in there instead. The Oklahoma City bombing, the 9/11 plot, and the murder of countless witnesses, politicians, and journalists who sought to expose them, including Senator Paul Wellstone and even Hunter S. Thompson. Everything, according to Gorton, has been an inside job. It is really something. The longest and most complete of Gorton's essays is titled 50 Years of the Deep State. To give you a taste of what he believes, a few brief excerpts on the JFK assassination. The assassination of JFK was part of a full-scale coup d'etat. The violent takeover, The violent takeover of our government by a group of criminals. I have not the slightest doubt in my mind that JFK's assassination was the work of a network of criminals embedded within the political system and power structure of the United States. Key among the players in the coup of 63 were LBJ, Allen Dulles, and the CIA, J. Edgar Hoover, and the FBI. Right-wing Texas oil executives, including Clint Murchison Sr., H.L. Hunt, and D.H. Byrd. The East Coast business establishment centered around Rockefeller interests and the Council on Foreign Relations. Curtis LeMay, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Other right-wing leaders of the military and elements of military intelligence and the Bush family, both Prescott and George H.W. LBJ planned to kill JFK from the moment he considered becoming vice president. And Gorton, just so you know, everybody, I know we played what we played this morning, but this is the next layer. And Gorton believes that the plotters of the assassination were ready to literally start a nuclear war as part of the cover-up. The contingencies beyond how to blame Oswald were much more serious. As it were superficially obvious that JFK's killing was the result of a conspiracy, Castro was to be blamed, and an invasion of Cuba was to quickly follow. Many anti-Castro Cubans who participated in the coup were deeply disappointed that the invasion of Cuba never materialized. I'm going to just remind you that Ashtar was in the mix here, because our CIA used that base to launch a nuke, fully activated, and heading towards L.A. downtown. It was taken out of its orbit and into space, outer space, and neutralized by Ashtar. This is why this never materialized. My studies of the coup of 63 have led me to believe that even graver fallback strategies were embedded in the plot. As JFK's killing was obviously perceived as being part of a large conspiracy and the United States public was not buying the Castor did it angle, the coup plotters were in truly dire straits. These desperate men who ran the military, FBI, some of the largest companies in the world, and the United States government faced the prospect of being hung for treason. And it shall come to pass. And I love everyone. And send more love. I believe that this darkest of scenarios envisioned by the coup plotters involved declaring martial law and blaming the Russians. Remember, on October 1st, 2008, George Bush was already announcing martial law when the U.S. Marshals picked him up and dragged him off the stage. Sorry, Charlie, come with us. And the scenarios envisioned by the coup plotters involved declaring martial law and blaming the Russians and taking the country to and possibly over the brink of nuclear war with Russia. Nobody's buying this blaming Russia stuff now. They're still trying, and they got a whole other way of trying to do it. The cover-up, Gorton writes, has been deadly. Over the years, certainly 50 and more, likely more than 100 people have been killed to preserve the secrets of the coup of 63, many witnesses, reporters, people who know too much, plot members, and are at risk of being exposed, overzealous law enforcement officials have all been killed since then. Some of these deaths were clearly violent. Many were made to look like something else. And still goes on, everybody. It's just about the end. They wouldn't be putting this finality here. Another of Gorton's writings, The Political Dominance of the Cabal, is a point-by-point primer on the cabal's alleged members of murder and murderous conspiracies. Example, Bill Clinton was the senior member of the Dixie Mafia, associated with the dozens of suspicious deaths, hundreds, folks. George H.W. Bush masterminded the savings and loan crisis, Reagan's shooting, and the domestic death squads. The third document, The Coup of 63, Part 1, is a JFK assassination-centric shorter version of the 50 years of the deep state. Yesterday, we called Mark Gorton to ask him about the authenticity of these documents. After a long pause, he said that he was mulling over the consequences for me as these documents came to light. Like what? People killing me and my children, he said. This has the potential to change my life. Gorton did confirm that he wrote the essays, though, which he described as work in progress. He even agreed to send us the most recent versions of the documents, which were the versions of the embedded below. In his email to us yesterday, Gorton described his fear. I am concerned because the criminal syndicate that I describe in these documents has a long history of harassing and killing people who describe it, what they do. They do not only kill the people they speak up, that speak up on occasion. They also kill their family members. I have a good life and 4 great kids, and I would prefer not to bring the wrath of a criminal government down upon my head. I would ask that you completely read all 3 documents and think about what they have to say. Having these documents suddenly appear on a blog like Gawker changes my risk profile in life. That being said, I do think that the truth needs to be told about what has happened to our democracy. And I have written these documents, and I have had sent them out to a limited audience. As you are interested in publishing this material, I ask that you talk to me and that this be done in a thoughtful manner. I would prefer that my life not be put in the jeopardy that by a casual, quick, one-off blog post. We have decided to publish the material. We trust that any shadowy forces will be kept at bay by the public attention we are drawing to this topic. Aho, Mitakliasin. Okay, let's do a quick read and do a little prayer at the beginning of the next book here by our venerable Dahani Yahu. The Learning Cherokee Way, Learning Cherokee Ways, the Yahoo Path. Everybody, we live in the most amazing of times. Okay, here we go. May this text reveal to each reader the stream of wisdom, which is the natural state. May one's experiences of direct insight as a child reveal the wisdom of the adult and bring forth integrated, skillful action which benefits all beings in this and every moment. I invite the reader to touch the open space of awareness from which one springs and consider who is and the unique voice one contributes. Who one is and the unique voice one contributes to the world. The past, present, and future exists in the now as projections of potential magnetized by view and action. The intention of this book is to remind each reader that we all have a direct connection to the great mystery. Whether we call it God, mind, or energy, we have all arisen from its potential, and as such are inseparable from this natural awakened awareness. The purpose of this book is to remind the reader of those holy moments to which there is clear access to this awareness. Those holy moments reveal a sense of beauty, of grace, and deep understanding, overstanding, of the interdependent relationships of life. This understanding is not only the gift to the meditator sitting in the woods. These experiences are revealed in every situation in all of our lives. Can you call our sister Rainbird, Captain Don there? Captain Misty Cat, Rama, can you ask them to call on Lady Master Rainbird? Can you do that? I don't see you there. Oh, okay. Okay. Is that at the right time or is that earlier?
It might have been earlier.
Can you hear me, Commander Don? Hello? Huh. It is my aspiration that through sharing my experiences, the reader will be reminded of the sacred moments in his...
I've been trying for 5 minutes.
Oh, you haven't reached her?
Yeah.
I see.
Keeps going to answering, missing. She might be...
It might not be that she can be reached. She's in Charleston.
Yeah.
South Carolina for Patty Cotarobos. Okay, well, we'll just read this. This is good for our sister is going to have a wonderful event in her life tomorrow. It's Palm Sunday. Hosanna, 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 Ho. It is my aspiration that through sharing my experiences, the reader will be reminded of the sacred moments in his or her own life as they have been touched by this great mystery, and that behind the many appearances, there is ultimately one truth that unites us all. Okay, that's good for tonight. We're at the bewitching midnight hour, and we will have... You ready, Rama? You got to talk louder.
I have a Sufi song that's 10 minutes.
Okay.
It's called
I Am Not From This World, and it's by Jalaluddin Rumi. Okay, let's go.
چه تدبیر ای مسلمانان که من خود را نمی دانم نه ترسا و یهودیم نه گبرم نه مسلمانم نه شرقیم نه غربیم نه بحریم نه بحریم نه از کان طبیعیم نه از افلاک گردانم
Thank you.
Muslim or Jew, not a Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi, or Zen. I'm not of any religion or cultural system. I'm not from the East or of the West. Not out of the ocean or up from the ground. Not natural or ethereal. Not composed of elements at all. I do not exist.
نه از دنیا نه از عقبا نه از جنت نه از دوزخ نه از آدم نه از حوا نه از فردوس رضوانم
I'm not an entity in this world or the next. I did not descend from Adam or Eve or any original story. My place is the priestess. A trace of the traces. have seen the both worlds as one. And that one call to and know. First, last, outer, inner, only that breath breathing, human being.
Takuyasin. I just want to describe to you, this lady did a whirling dervish dance, and that's a spin, and she went faster and faster and faster, and she was able to stop on a dime and then sing that last song to you and I, and let that go up for all things now, to be coming back to the place we call balance. They said that the hope and all what it was, that last little phrase, hope and all hope and fear has, I mean, basically in Europe, there's a sense of despair and giving up. And since despair is not an option, as the Buddha says, it is up to each one of us, since we're all one beingness, to call this in. Call in this joy. We are at the end and the beginning, and I am another yourself. And in that inshallah place, may that place of love and truth and peace and freedom and justice and beauty prevail on earth. Inshallah, everybody. And Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Ahomi Takuyasin. And come tomorrow and Monday to Cheryl's call. It's really an amazing time to do this together, the more we can gather like this at this time. And it's same numbers here, 213-342-3000. And the pin code is 9-4-6-7-4-4-1-pound. So until then, it's 9:15 Eastern, 6:15 Pacific. Namaste.